Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about flower gardening and vegetable gardening and all sorts of events coming up. We're talking this segment about the play Manhattan Glass by Joey Chavez, produced by Teatro Paraguas. Sitting here at the table with me right now are playwright Joey Chavez, and we are delighted to welcome also Elias Gallegos, who plays the role of Anthony, the grandson in this play, and Juanita Sena Shannon, who plays the role of Maria Hesch. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk about the characters in this play. First of all, Maria Hesch and Louis Hesch, a married couple based on real people.
Yes, based on my grandparents, Louis and Maria Hesch. The original version of the play, I used different names, but then I thought I might as well just use their names because everybody's going to know anyway.
And they're okay with that?
They both passed away.
Mm-hmm. So this is a play about, and their grandson, Anthony, who is again played by Elias, about people who are elderly now, but who worked for the Manhattan Project.
That's correct. The play takes place in 1981, and it's based on interviews I had with my grandparents and my remembrances of them when I was growing up.
And I'm assuming that to some extent the role of Anthony is based on you?
Yes. My middle name is Anthony, so I put him right in there.
Okay. So what is amazing is the amount of secrecy surrounding Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project, persists for decades.
Yes. It still does today. Many people were indoctrinated not to talk about it. And so the response I often get, well, we're not supposed to talk about that, even though it was 20 years ago.
What did your grandparents actually do, and how were you able to find out?
My grandfather was asked to work there first. He was a draftsman. And my grandmother had taken his drafting courses down at New Mexico State in Las Cruces. So when he went up to the project, they asked her to join as well. Her penmanship was so fine, my grandmother's, that Enrico Fermi asked her to be his personal secretary. So she ended up working for him and at that point was making more money than my grandfather.
And the two of them, when they came home, do you have any sense of how much they talked or didn't talk about their day at work?
My talking to them was way after the fact, in the 60s and 70s, when I would go over and visit. And I knew they worked at the project, but unless I asked them questions, they never really talked about it in the house or anything like that. So the older I got, the more I would, you know, ask them, because it was kind of fascinating that they were in this very secret project that nobody talked about, and it was still, we still had the sirens on top of the hill by my house in Casa Solana, so we'd have the sirens to do the drills. And growing up here, I remember having to do the duck and cover drills, so it was still really fresh in my mind when I was young. And then in the 70s, that kind of just all sort of went away, and that's when I really became interested and then started talking to them and asking them questions about their involvement with the project.
What was the process like of talking to them and drawing them out?
I did it without, kind of like in the play, I talked to them in separate rooms. I didn't walk over and say, I'm going to interview you now about the Manhattan Project. I would just, you know, sort of ask questions about what exactly did you do? And do you remember this person or that person? And so that's how they began to open up and tell me about the process.
And the play hinges on, of course, the conflicting emotions of having worked on that.
Yes, but they were both very religious. And my grandmother, one of the quotes in the play that she actually told me when I asked her about the project, she said that it was a godless project that was worked on a bunch of godless people that never should have been worked on in the first place. So she had very strong feelings about it. My grandfather was a little bit more forgiving because he thought it was for the right reason. They didn't know if Germany was working on the bomb, and they didn't want people to die on the beaches of Japan, is what he told me. He said, you know, we would have lost thousands of young men had we had to invade Japan. So he was a little bit more on the side of it had to be done. And it was going to be done, so might as well have been done by the United States.
At the same time, still, there was this whole question in the play, and I don't know how much we want to give away or not, because people should come and see the play, which is opening this weekend. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Teatro Paraguas studio. But this whole question of responsibility for having built something so incredibly destructive.
Well, I could tell it weighed on both of them, even though it wasn't spoken out loud, that they had done this and that they had given mankind the ability to destroy itself, and they were significant in its process. So they, I think they carried that for their entire lives.
Tell us about the title Manhattan Glass.
Well, in the play, there's a piece of trinitite that my grandfather had, and it looked to me when I was young like a piece of melted glass. And so it was the Manhattan Project, of course, and then he had that piece of glass. So that's how those two words together.
And so trinitite from the Trinity bomb test.
Yes, from the test.
Did he actually see them?
He wasn't at the first detonation of the bomb. He knew about it. He was brought into confidence several weeks before it had happened, but they had all pretty much guessed by that point. They just knew by the language that was being used and that type of stuff that it was, they were working on a bomb. They didn't know how powerful it was going to be, but they knew that that's what they were doing.
There is an added dimension in this play, which is that the character of the grandfather is losing his memory.
That's the most significant part for me as the writer, because he was such a vibrant and lively and knowledgeable. I thought he was always a genius when I was growing up. He could build anything. He could tell all kinds of stories. And as he started to lose his capacity through Alzheimer's, I could just kind of see it slipping away. And so that's why I would continue to ask him more and more questions about his involvement. And he could remember the things way back in the past. He had trouble remembering more recent things.
I can sympathize with that.
So
Juanita, what is it like to play the character of Maria Hesch? How did you find her in yourself as an actor?
I'm glad to tell you that having grown up in Santa Fe, I knew the Hesch family. In fact, small world, Joey grew up at the top of my street, the street I still live in, and his mother has been a friend of mine all my adult life, Bernice. And she's referred to a lot during the piece.
Yes, she is.
Maria talks to her grandson about how she doesn't want to be a burden to her daughter, who is Joey's mother, Bernice. Maria Hesch is a personal responsibility, too, because she was a wonderful artist, and she captured our history in a way that many other artists haven't. She felt it was very, very important to project all of her memories from her childhood and the stories from her childhood, and she does that in her paintings, and it's a big part of the story, how she was able to find the peace of what she did in Los Alamos, peace from her husband's illness, in her work. And that's what she wants to be remembered for, not Los Alamos.
And, of course, it starts and throughout the piece, her artwork is almost another character.
It is. It's true. It's very, very, very true. I found out in doing research on Joey's grandma that Maria fell in love with Louis Hesch when she was 12 years old. He was 14, and they were childhood sweethearts, and they never looked back. They never saw anyone else. They married and they moved, and when they went to Las Cruces and he was teaching, she was already married to him when she took that drafts drafting course, and thus became Enrico Fermi's assistant. Another piece that I like in the story, and it has to do with the secrecy too, is that Louis and Maria didn't tell each other what they did. What they did up there. She even tells him, we weren't supposed to talk about our work, remember, not even at home. So now that they're in their 70s, they're finally admitting to each other what their participation was in Los Alamos on the Manhattan Project.
Through the vehicle of the grandson, who's played by you, Elias Gallegos, tell us about your relationship to the role of the grandson.
Well, having this opportunity to play the role of Anthony is something that I've been thrilled to be a part of. It's just been an amazing process. And I do feel that I had some insider information just growing up here in Santa Fe. I grew up with a grandfather who helped build some of the barracks for the military up in Los Alamos. And there was tales, for I wasn't alive, but, you know, there'd be a Christmas dinner and there'd be a knock at the door and they'd say, Mr. Sanchez, we need you. And my grandfather would pack his briefcase and they'd head out the door, and then he'd come, sometimes return 2-3 days later and not be able to tell anybody why he left or what was going on, but at the same time was never asked by anybody either, because they knew that was something that you just didn't talk about. And but I never really had the opportunity to get to know my grandfather. I grew up with my grandmother, so this play, I really reveled in the fact that I had this opportunity to be friends with my grandfather. And in the play, Lewis is just somebody who's like a superhuman in the sense that he has so much history, he's so knowledgeable, and I look up to him as somebody who, when I'm away at college, as Anthony, you know, I see myself telling stories to other kids like, oh, you don't understand, my grandpa is a genius. When I go back, I'm going to have some stories. When I come back, I'm going to blow your minds. And then to walk into this situation and not really see or be able to recognize those qualities in my grandfather, it's a very electrifying situation that is going on. And I feel like because I'm this young kid who's currently in school, things are, in 1981, things are being done differently in the world. I think I can save my grandfather. I think, you know, together, if we talk about this and we get some help, I really do believe that we can reverse some of these signs of Alzheimer's. And that's, I think that's the innocence that Anthony brings to the story. Whether it's true or not, that's my fight.
Right. And there is this... What do you know, college boy? You haven't been here for years.
Exactly, yes.
Was that you, Joey?
Yeah, it is. And in the crafting of it, it's gone through many different drafts. That was one of the last parts that I put on so that Anthony wasn't quite so, you know, knowledgeable and have all the answers to everything when he was just looking at his grandparents through a very small lens. And being gone so much, he didn't really know what was going on currently except through small letters and, you know, phone calls and things like that. So, you know, we often go off to college and we've taken one psychology course and we can, you know, we tell our entire family what's wrong with them. You know, Psych 101, I know how to fix the world.
The younger we are, the more we know.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's how he came back and kind of looked at the world. And so I made an effort to incorporate that in there. In the reading several months ago, some people commented on that they felt that was appropriate in there and didn't come out of left field.
I appreciate the humor that Joey's written in for his grandparents' relationship. I'm working with Oscar Rodriguez again, and he's playing Lewis. And Maria and Lewis live life, and they argue hysterically.
Right.
Hysterically. I one line that Joey did not put in the show, but I feel all the time, is looking at Anthony and saying, shut up, we're fighting, leave us alone.
Yeah, she says a lot without saying a word.
And it's just a pleasure to have that love affair going and being such a trusting relationship that they can argue.
Right.
You know, it's lovely.
Now, when you, Joey, were writing this play and then going through the drafts, you have a story that probably more than many plays is based on a true story, based on your story, based on your family. How do you take that material and craft it in such a way that it is functional drama?
The original draft didn't possess that at all. I was living in Atlanta at the time and just moved to New York City. So I was under the influence of the Southern writers and the comedies that were coming out of there. So I had three extra characters, and there was some slapstick and, you know, kind of I was dancing around it. It was produced in Atlanta, and it didn't work. And I wasn't really sure why, and I sent it to another director, and the director rightfully told me, it was Judith Joseph, she said, you're dancing around the topic. It's not. It's about your memories of your grandfather. It's not about the comedy. It's not about really the situation. That's the strength of the play. So just, you know, throw everything else away and really focus on that. So that's what I did, was to try and eliminate the things that really didn't have anything to do with the story. And the subplots that came out weren't planned. They just happened to emerge through the writing. So that's it's not just about their involvement with the bomb or their the way they fight or Lewis's attempt to contact the president of the United States.
Yeah, that's something that keeps happening in the play.
Yeah, or any of these other things. It's a compilation of several different things, including the Alzheimer's and the guilt that Maria feels with being a burden and not wanting people to know that she's having trouble with Lewis. And you know, so there are many different layers in there.
So you can experience it, I think, as an audience member on an empathetic level in a lot of different ways.
Yes.
As a family story as well as a kind of the politics and science of the whole thing.
Yes.
We're talking to Joey Chavez, playwright, and Juanita Sena Shannon and Elias Gallegos about the play Manhattan Glass, which is being produced at Teatro Paraguas, directed by Fran Martone, who's been on this show before. And Teatro Paraguas, they are busy.
They're really busy.
I usually have them on, but I haven't even been able to get all the productions that they've done on the air lately because they just do so much. And they've taken this little building in a sign where you expect to see small manufacturing of nails or something and made it into a theater. It's an incredible little space and a little business park off of Richards Avenue.
Yeah, Richards Lane.
Richards Lane.
Mm-hmm.
So the address is 3221 Richards Lane in Santa Fe, and you can go to teatroparaguas.org. You can also call for tickets, 424-1601. It's this Friday and Saturday, April 29th and 30th at 8 in the evening and Sunday at 2. And the 2 o'clock on Sunday is Pay What You Wish, which is very nice, too. It allows even more members of the community to go to this small theater.
Yes, and we do encourage everyone to make a reservation because it is a small house. And oftentimes people don't realize it if they've never been there before and they show up, you know, 5 minutes before curtain and they're sold out.
Yeah, and that happens.
It happens quite often.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. And anything you want to add or let people know before we go?
I would just like to thank you for providing this opportunity for us to get the word out about Manhattan Glass. And please do come see the show. You will have an enjoyable time and maybe even learn something about yourself.
Really? Now, Joey Chavez, this is your current project. Do you anything else on deck for us to be looking for?
I've written two pieces that will be in the New Mexico School for the Arts production of Brink at the Lenzic in the month of May.
Nice. Joey, this is one weekend. Are you still working on this for future production of this play, Manhattan Glass?
Yes, it will be included in a festival of three playwrights this summer that will take place in three different venues. There will be at Teatro Paraguas, it'll also move to Warehouse 21, and it'll also have a weekend in Los Alamos at Fuller Lodge, and it's part of the Trinity Festival, and it's three different plays about the Los Alamos area.
Interesting, and so at that time we'll be particularly inviting scientists to go and check it out as well.
Yes, Teatro Paraguas in their wisdom has targeted the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb as one of the dates.
Have you spoken to scientists in the production of this? Is that kind of conversations that you've had that have fed this play?
No, I haven't. But we do expect to have some sort of talk back up there and meet with people.
We did have some people from Los Alamos at the
reading.
Public reading. And they had some interesting things to say about the story, and they liked the idea that it wasn't so scientific and it wasn't politically biased, but about people who had to go to work.
Thanks again so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Fran Cole. She's outreach director from the Santa Fe Botanical Garden, and Aaron Wade, who is the owner and founder of the restaurant Vinaigrette. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hello.
So we are talking because there's a couple of occasions coming up relating to gardens and gardening and food and all that kind of thing. The 7th Annual Garden Fair, which is being presented by the Santa Fe Master Gardener Association, whom we've had on the show a number of times, is coming up this Saturday, the 30th of April, from 10 to 4 at the County Fairgrounds. It's a free, big, huge, amazing event. And Aaron, you're going to be speaking there, and your topic is fearless vegetable gardening.
Yes, it is.
Is vegetable gardening something that is usually riddled with fear and anxiety?
I think so. A lot of people that I've talked to, and even myself when I was getting started, there always seems to be this idea, and I suppose in many different things in life, but especially growing your own food, that there's some right way to do it, you know, a set of tried and true instructions that you have to stick to. And one thing I learned when I was starting was that you really have to make it your own. And there's a great book called Fields of Plenty by Michael Abelman, and I had kind of a breakthrough moment reading that book, because he travels across the country profiling different organic farms, and it was just amazing to me how many different kinds of gardeners there were. They were as various as the people who tend them, and there's a million different ways to do almost everything, and you really have to follow your own personality, your own microclimate, the demands of your individual garden, and who you are and what works for you. And so for me, that was really freeing for getting started to just go for it.
The way you make it sound is that it's almost a form of personal and artistic expression, that when you bring the best out of it, you're putting so much of your own character into it.
Absolutely. It's absolutely a creative act. And it's really, it's more empowering to think about it that way, because you can make it your own.
So one of the things that you did was you discovered that you didn't like tractors.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how do you garden? I mean, if you're gardening for a restaurant, is that farming or is that gardening?
Well, it's probably, we're a farm, but basically all the methods that we use are very applicable to a home garden, because we have about 2 to 3 acres garden in active garden right now, but the way that we plant is with raised beds, because we had a really damaged soil profile at the farm. It was terraced a long time ago, so it was really prone to erosion. We had a lot of big equipment kind of trampling all over it, so we had really big problems with soil compaction, and so we do all raised beds, which was originally designed for a home garden. It's called French Intensive Raised Bed Gardening, and it was designed for small-scale gardening and maximizing your production in small areas. So, but it also is great for the kind of soil challenges we have in New Mexico. So I'll be talking a lot about that, which is my style and works for my garden and my soil. It might not for some people in Nambe, where our farm is, our garden. We have clay or silty clay soils, so that means they're very, very, the mineral part of the soil is really, really, has very small particles, so it compacts easily. So with raised bed gardening, you double dig these beds, you aerate 2 whole feet of arable soil, and you can add back organic matter at that time. So you basically, you fluff up the soil and you create air and water spaces for the plant roots, which are, in our soils as they are, they're very, very compressed or compacted. So it really helps for intensive gardening or agricultural purposes to aerate them in that way.
And then you raise them by having like walls of some kind?
You can use wood frames or you can just slope them. We just slope the sides of the beds, and that works fine for our purposes. It also is great for irrigating, for drip irrigation, because you can, you know, the soil then does a better job of capturing any water that you put on it, and it's perfect for drip lines. So it really does a lot of different things that are perfect for our Santa Fe soils and weather.
So how did you come to start the restaurant Vinaigrette? I mean, you have an Ivy League education, you worked in fashion design, you worked in fancy kind of New York magazine journalism, and suddenly you're out in Nambe growing arugula.
Right. Well, it was quite a transition. I was in Milan, actually, in fashion design before I moved to New Mexico, but I had spent a summer in Santa Fe and loved it, and my family had this property, and I think the dirt was calling me. I was really tired of cities and a little burned out in fashion, and I wanted to get my hands back in the dirt. But one of the things, incidentally, that fashion and gardening do really have in common is, just like you have to make it your own and it's a form of personal expression in gardening, it's the same is true of fashion. It's not really about what's in style or the perfect length or the perfect cut. It's more about what's perfect for you and what your individual style is. And so it's really the same. The same in gardening, and I found that out in a rather quirky way, but or quirky transition from fashion to gardening. But I really think that's a similarity there. So,
and also, when you decide that you're going to put together a restaurant, you've got a kind of a sense of aesthetics that you might not have had otherwise.
Right. Well, the design part was really natural for me. I love design still. I think, you know, and the farm is a form of that, and then the restaurant definitely. The interior design and all the little choices that had to be made, I felt very prepared for by my background in fashion design, but and also just my upbringing with my mom, who's very, very aesthetically aware, we'll say. But, yeah, it all kind of actually came together in the restaurant and the farm as far as my sort of diverse background a little bit all over the place. So the restaurant really felt like something that connected the dots for me.
And so when you have, a piece of land, one of the things that I know that you wrote and have talked about is that it really doesn't take all that much land to grow food.
Absolutely. Especially if you're really taking care of the land and you're adding back organic matter. It's amazing how productive even a single raised bed can be, especially, you know, there's different harvesting methods. So you can continually harvest, you can stagger your plantings. Especially for like a home gardener, we have a pretty intense demand and we're able to keep up with that with fairly what I think most people would be surprised at the space that we have, how productive it is. But for a home gardener, you can harvest as you need, which is the greatest way to keep things fresh. Everything stays more nutrient rich that way. So you can go out and harvest only what you need, and you can continue to harvest. For instance, like if you need romaine for a salad, you can harvest the outermost leaves and keep, and the plant will keep growing. There's a lot of ways that you can maximize production. And also with a raised bed, you can plant closer together more intensively because they have 2 feet deep of accessible soil and nutrients.
How do you fertilize your garden?
So we're all organic. We use a variety of different composts and manures. We also do green manures, which are planting cover crops. And that's something that even a home, it sort of sounds like something that's very large scale. But like a home gardener, when in the off season or in between plantings, you can plant like an alfalfa or something that's less water demanding. There's certain kinds of field peas, legumes that fix nitrogen from the atmosphere into the soil. So they actually replenish the soil and you can turn that in and it's called a green manure. So it's a great way to improve soil quality. So we do a lot of that. And we also add back a lot of aged chicken manure. And we also compost and have a worm pile out at the farm. Anything that we can do to add back organic matter. Because the desert, in general, has very low organic matter. So we're thinking in a more holistic way about improving the soil as opposed to adding back synthetic nitrogen or phosphorus or potassium.
And it's something that there's so much discussion about is almost closed-loop systems where you've got the animals making manure that then fertilize the plants, which then feed the animals and then feed us and so on. And the more of that you do, the less stuff you actually have to buy.
Right, exactly. I mean, natural ecosystems are very healthy, and they're constantly replenishing themselves. And we're just in any kind of healthy garden, you're just kind of trying to reconnect with that that natural system of replenishing organic matter into the soil.
So the whole question, we're talking to Aaron Wade, who is the founder of Vinaigrette Restaurant, and you grow all the food. I mean, basically all the salad that we're eating is from your farm,
right,
in Nambe?
So, yeah, we grow all of the mixed greens, the arugula, the radish. There's certain things that we can't keep up with. So we're doing, in the high growing season, we're doing about 70% of the produce that we're using. And then in the off season, we have to supplement and purchase. But we do as much as we possibly can. And the growing season in Santa Fe is fairly short. So we have a greenhouse where we get some stuff going in the winter as well. We do a lot of microgreens and babies and stuff like that.
So let's talk about the botanical garden for a moment.
Okay.
Fran, so what and where is the Santa Fe Botanical Garden?
Well, the Santa Fe Botanical Garden is a nonprofit organization. We've been in Santa Fe for some 25 years.
And there is no real botanical garden right now, though we're in the process of raising the funds to build one. We do manage two really gorgeous nature preserves. One is called the Leonora Curtin Wetland Preserve, and that's on the south side near Rancho de las Golondrinas. And the other nature preserve is called the Ortiz Mountains Educational Preserve, and that's a rugged high mountain preserve in the Ortiz Mountains. Both of those preserves are open to the public May through October. They're about to open this weekend, and we have lots of activities happening there all summer. However, our real focused goal is to open a real botanical garden. We have 13 acres at Museum Hill, which has been leased to us by the city of Santa Fe and the state of New Mexico combined. And this land is located up off the overflow parking lot near the museums at Museum Hill. And this is a 13-acre site that spans two sides of a long and very beautiful little arroyo. And someday we're going to put a botanical garden there, hopefully even starting something this summer, but no promises.
So having just talked with Aaron about all the different methods that you use for vegetable gardening, are there similarities to what you would use to, when you make a botanical garden?
Well, certainly there are similarities. We're going to be planting, of the 13 acres, we're going to be planting three of those acres in what are called cultivated gardens, so they will be closely managed, and there will be gardens and courtyards with themes and different kinds of plantings. We will garden for Santa Fe using water that we both catch in the soil and catch on the rooftop of a nearby state building.
And so water catchment, that's something, do you do that as well, Aaron, for the vegetables?
Yeah, actually we have a rain capture system, and we try to save as much as we can. So it's probably, you know, the house, if you can get a building that you can catch rainwater from, you're better off because the more area you have. So that sounds like a great setup. We still have to supplement with our ditch water, and hopefully we'll see what happens this year. The ditch isn't supposed to be running for long, but again, drip irrigation and raised bed minimizes what we have to use, so we really try to conserve water.
The botanical garden has will be using city water and also, as I say, water that we'll hopefully be catching on a nearby state building. We will be planting plants that are suitable to this region.
Suitable to this region, meaning majority xeric plants that are native to this region?
All different kinds of plants, Mary Charlotte. We won't be just planting native plants and just planting xeric plants, but there will be different gardens showing and demonstrating the many different ways that one can garden in Santa Fe. So there will be a lavender garden and a rose garden. There will be an orchard with many different kinds of fruit trees that grow very well in this region. There will be a xeric garden and on. We'll be doing gardening, planting gardens of many different kinds in this 3-acre cultivated area.
I, being perhaps the worst gardener in Santa Fe County, have managed not to kill the roses in my yard that were there when I moved in. Roses are very surprisingly hardy.
Right. There are some roses that are that do very well here. Yes, we will have a Santa Fe rose garden.
Now, you are participating in the garden fair. What will you be doing there?
We will have a table at the Master Gardener Fair, which goes on every year. There's one of the buildings is devoted to having vendors or different tables with different nonprofits and businesses in the gardening area. And so we will have a table there, and we will be selling tickets to our upcoming garden tours, which are coming up in June. And we'll be telling folks about our plant sale, which is coming up on Mother's Day weekend.
Yes.
The weekend after the Master Gardener Fair. We will be having a plant sale on Saturday, May 6th and Sunday, May 7th.
And that is under the tent at Museum Hill.
You know what? I said the wrong thing. Friday, May 6th.
From 3 to
and
6.
Saturday, May 7th from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday is Mother's Day, and we'll be home resting.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And so that's open to the public, and people can... Now, when you talk to people who are interested in gardening, what kind of questions do they most often have for you?
People have all kinds of questions. People want to know what to plant here, how to plant here, if they can plant other things besides those that are designated as xeric. Lots of people ask if certain plants will winter over here. There's all kinds of questions about our growing season and when to put the plants in and when is the last frost really?
Is well, it when is the last frost
later
really?
Later and later.
It's definitely later than now. I mean, it could freeze tonight, so it's definitely later.
Remember last year we had a snow on the 30th or the 31st of May.
Yes, and lots of people lost their fruit. Yeah, for sure. Now, I have my tomatoes in the ground with water walls. What about you, Erin?
We lost some tomatoes last year. I don't put stuff until the end of May. Our average last frost date was the 15th, and because we keep having these late ones, it keeps moving even later, which it's really, really late. If you do some sort of protection like that, it's fine. But we put ours in towards the end of May, and even last year with that snow, we lost a few.
Right.
So I recommend usually waiting, but it's hard because they need to go in the ground when they need to go in the ground. So,
what are water walls?
Water walls are these cool plastic tents that you can buy at any nursery or garden store. And you stick them over your plants, and they have little channels in them that you fill with water, and they form a little water tent, and they become hot inside like little tiny greenhouses that protect your plant. So I, for one, like to plant tomatoes in water walls starting now because it gives them a little bit of a head start. However, Erin and lots of other people who plant at the end of May, you know, perhaps are doing the right thing too, because my plants don't really get the biggest head start, so she might start her plants bigger.
Yeah, we let ours get a little bit bigger, although
right.
I do mainly soil blocks. So I soil blocking is a method where the soil itself sort of is the container for the plant. So there's only so big that it can get kind of at that point, but... I think it's great to get a little bit of a head start because we do have a problem at the end of the year sometimes with not getting to ripeness. So mm-hmm. we plant.
Oh, is that right? So
yeah.
it's September, October, and it's starting to freeze and your plants aren't all ripe
right,
yet?
And even if it's not freezing, it starts to get so cool that the ripening process just really slows
right.
down, which is another time when you can pull out the wall of water, actually.
Right.
And that helps them ripen.
Yes.
It just keeps, it's like an insulator. Yeah.
Right. See, in other parts of the country, it stays warm in the evening. But here, even in July, August, after dinner time, it starts to get cool. And so tomatoes don't have, you know, 24/7 warmth.
Now, I think of botanical gardens as places where you have just the most beautiful flowers. And there was a botanical garden where I used to live that was not only beautiful, but it was like a smell fest. You'd walk through it and these beautiful smells would waft around you. What about...
That's
food.
What our garden will be like.
Yeah. But do you grow anything that people can eat?
Well, we hope to have an edible part of the garden someday. The Santa Fe Botanical Garden at Museum Hill will be built in more or less 3 to 4 stages. And in one of those, or phases, I should say, and in one of those areas, we will have someday an edible garden. And so we are hoping to plant vegetables and many different things that are edible and get the kids in this town involved, just like we'll get the kids in this town involved in the orchard. The orchard will be planted in phase one, and when we start getting fruit, we'll have all kinds of educational programs around that.
Growing trees how big are the trees when you plant them when you start the orchard?
You're going over my head here. I'm not actually buying the plants, but I'm through the trees.
But, I mean, you're not getting full-grown trees that are making
apples. No, we're not getting full-grown trees. And we're very happily getting advice and consult from Gordon Tooley of Tooley's Trees up in Truches. We'll probably be buying some of our trees from him. I'm sure they'll be well on their way, but not full grown.
I mean, it'll be interesting once you get kids involved to have them see every year what it takes to make a tree grow, and then that first year that they bear fruit will have to be very exciting.
Yes, very exciting. Very exciting. We're looking forward to that new garden.
So do you also grow fruit trees, Erin?
We do have some fruit trees, but they're not the primary thing that we do out at the farm. And I'm actually excited to listen to Gordon Tooley from Tooley's Trees at the garden fair, because I don't know as much about trees. So I would like to hear what he has to say. We have some of his trees actually out at the farm, but we just have a one little area, and I'd like to expand on it, because actually when you get a fruit, it's in a year where we don't have the late frost, it's just so amazing how abundant. We have one peach tree that was about falling over with fruit. So.
Right, and you can make peach pies for the rest of your life. Yeah.
Well, I have one nectarine tree in my small yard, and it didn't blossom this year. And I was talking to some people who have a lot of peach trees, and they didn't blossom at all. There's not going to be a single peach. I'm not going to have a single nectarine.
I know, it's a heartbreaking world.
But many other fruits that that you will then, when the time comes, presumably serve in your restaurant.
Yeah, so because we do a lot of fruit pies. That's kind of our signature dessert. We do grapes, my grandma's pie recipe. So we do, you know, apple pie, peach pie, berry pie. So that's where we end up using stuff. But we'll also do some really amazing shortcakes with fresh fruit.
Sounds delicious.
I know. Let's go there right now. Not that there isn't good food here at the Santa Fe Baking Company, which is also delicious. But it's a whole different thing. I mean, this whole farm-to-table concept is such a great example of a truly local business where your person, your ideas make the whole thing happen. And then you've got, do you work with a lot of people at the farm?
I have some help. I have my friends John and Bea Steiner live out on the farm, and John works full time there. He was at Seeds of Change before, but now he's because I was sort of making myself crazy trying to do both the restaurant, which is incredibly demanding of your time, and the farm, which is equally demanding in a different way. So he's the foreman there right now and managing stuff and doing a lot of the harvesting, and he started last summer. But John and Bea have been out there helping out for a few years. So we have help, and we'll bring in when we need a little extra, when we have a project going on, like when you start double digging those beds, it's a little labor intensive. So I have help, certainly.
And what about the recipes? Did you come up with all of that too?
Yeah, the recipes are mine. My mom's a great cook. And when I was alone out there on 10 acres with my dogs, cooking for myself, I started making salads. And for me, it represented something that was healthful, loving, but not deprivational in any way. So food that was, you know, really good for you, but also really delicious. So I started playing around with different flavor combinations, and that's kind of what is at the core of our menu, are these fun, playful, different combinations, and that sort of each salad sort of makes its own little flavor combination sing. So that's how the menu came about.
Fran Cole, how can people get involved in the Santa Fe Botanical Garden? What's the role of the public?
Well, amazingly, the Santa Fe Botanical Garden has a lean staff. We have 3 people on staff. I'm one of them. And we rely heavily on the generosity of volunteer time. We have a volunteer core of approximately 300 volunteers. About 200 of them are active. And everybody who is a volunteer gets involved in so many ways. People help us with the garden tours, planning them, working them, staffing them. There's volunteers who help us with the plant sale, choosing plants, setting up all the logistical details of an event of that size. We have an amazing educational program at the Wetland, and volunteers work out there with school children from different schools around the city, teaching them about the Wetland and the critters that live out there.
And the incredible importance of Wetland to New Mexico's ecosystem.
Exactly. Just the fact that we have a Wetland in Santa Fe with water that runs all year round is fairly incredible. We have volunteer docents who work at those two preserves, the Ortiz Mountains Preserve and the Leonora Curtin. Those docents work weekends teaching folks about the two preserves and giving tours. We have all kinds of volunteers, volunteers raising money, working at the new Museum Hill site, helping us to prune trees and to give visitors tours of the new site to tell everybody what we're doing. And then, of course, we're a membership organization. We have over 400 members, and our goal for 2011 is to get perhaps up to 1,000 members, and membership starts at $35 and goes up from there. Members get all kinds of perks, free newsletters, free entry into lots of activities that we offer, discounts at some of the conferences that we offer, discounts at local restaurants. There's just all kinds of perks when you belong to the Botanical Garden. You do not have to be a member to be a volunteer, but our volunteers quickly like to support us as a member because they see the importance of the revenue that is generated from membership.
And the spring plant sale is Friday and Saturday, May 6th and 7th. For people who want to get more information, you can call 505-471-9103 or go to santafebotanicalgarden.org. And meanwhile, the 7th Annual Garden Fair presented by the Santa Fe Master Gardener Association is this coming Saturday, April 30th from 10 to 4 at the County Fairgrounds on Rodeo Road. And Santa Fe Greenhouses is sponsoring that. And Aaron Wade from Vinaigrette, you are talking about fearless vegetable gardening. Once again, that's where we started, and maybe that's where we'll end up in this program today. But there's also a couple of other talks. One is from Scott Calhoun, who is giving a talk called Fun and Frugal, Big Garden Ideas for Small Budgets. That's relevant to many of us.
And he's a neat guy. He's written a lot of garden books, and he works as a writer for, I believe, Sunset Magazine. He's a neat guy. That's a great talk to go to.
And Gordon Tooley, whom you both mentioned, will be talking about trees, selection, planting, and care. And David Salmon from Santa Fe Greenhouses and Scott Calhoun are talking, and this is a very interesting one. Every year, I think this is the year where I'm actually going to plant something and not have it die. We will see what happens. But this talk is called 10 Best Perennials for Santa Fe, and that'll be interesting. What do you think? What's your best guess? What are some good perennials for Santa Fe?
Galardia. Lavender.
Okay, I know what that is.
Agastache. That's one of David Salmon's favorites, and he's right, that is a good perennial. Lots of roses are good for Santa Fe. What do you think, Erin?
You're either a vegetable gardener.
I'm thinking about
or flower
gardener.
Sage. Yeah, seriously, my mom is a total ornamental gardener, and she's not a vegetable gardener at all. But it seems like Russian sage does incredibly well.
Russian sage. All the sages do incredibly well.
Well,
lots of herbs do incredibly well.
Yeah, herbs, actually, we do. It's herbs like spare soils like ours.
Is that
good.
Right?
Yeah.
How do you get to... The one time I planted basil, grasshoppers ate every single bit of it. I mean, there was not one square centimeter left for
me. Yeah, basil's tough because pests really love it because it's got those tender, beautiful leaves. You know, some of the more concentrated, woodier herbs are a lot more resilient, like rosemary.
Right.
But although rosemary is not hardy at all here in the winter, no matter what anyone says.
Well, much more to talk about, but I want to thank you both for being with us. Fran Cole from Santa Fe Botanical Garden and Aaron Wade, who is the founder and creator of Vinaigrette, which is, what's the address over there?
It's 709 Don Cubero Alley, which is, it's basically right on Cerrillos between... right off of Cerrillos, tucked back a little bit between Guadalupe and Paseo de Peralta. So down from Whole Foods. It's hard to find the first time.
Right, and then it's easy to find, and the food is terrific. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank
See you at the plant sale.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.